Daniel Yawowiecka.
Sir Keir Starmer has said that a peace agreement for Ukraine is vital for the UK. Speaking at the Scottish Labour Conference in Glasgow, the Prime Minister said that it was in the national interest to help find a resolution to the conflict because of the threat posed by Russia to the UK's security and the effect of the war on the cost of living. He will meet President Trump in Washington on Thursday to discuss the war. Ukraine has been hit by the single biggest drone attack of its war with Russia so far, ahead of the third anniversary of the start of the conflict tomorrow. Ukrainian officials said Russia had launched 267 drones across at least 13 regions of the country. More than half of them were shot down. Three casualties have been reported so far. Israel's defence minister says the army has evacuated 40,000 Palestinians from refugee camps in the occupied West Bank. Israel Katz said residents would not be permitted to return for the coming year to prevent the resurgence of terrorism. Earlier, Israel said it had postponed the release of more than 600 Palestinian prisoners because of what it described as ceasefire violations. Hamas has accused Israel of deliberately trying to disrupt the Gaza deal. The Pope has asked Catholics to pray for him as he continues to receive treatment for double pneumonia in hospital in Rome. In place of his traditional Angelus prayer, the pontiff released a statement saying he was confidently continuing his hospitalisation after having what the Vatican described as a respiratory crisis yesterday. Germany is going to the polls for a snap parliamentary election today. The leader of the conservative CDU party, Friedrich Merz, is tipped to replace the Social Democrat incumbent Olaf Scholz. The far-right Alternative for Germany party is predicted to win its biggest share of the national vote to date. Archaeologists believe they may have found the second tomb of King Thutmose II in Egypt. Field director Dr. Piers Litherland said that the pharaoh's mummified body could lie in this new tomb. A look now at the weather. There'll be heavy rain, especially in northern England and Wales. East Anglia and southeastern England should mainly stay dry. And that's the latest BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Daniel Levitin is a psychologist and neuroscientist who is fascinated by the way our brains respond to music. He first worked as a musician, playing in bands, and then became a record producer and engineer. He's worked with some of the best-known names in the world, including Stevie Wonder, Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, Sting, and the Grateful Dead. In his 30s, he went back to university to study psychology, and he's now Professor Emeritus at McGill University and has written several bestsellers investigating why music has such a powerful effect on us as a species. His most recent book, Music as Medicine, is about the healing power of music and how it might be used to help treat post-traumatic stress disorder and slow the spread of neurodegenerative diseases. Daniel, we've not got some of those great pop musicians we've just been hearing about, but we do have Debussy, Dvorak, Thelonious, Monk. But first, it's Beethoven.
Beethoven, yeah. Like many people, I first heard this particular piece in Walt Disney's Fantasia. I came to that movie late in the game, relatively. I was a teenager, but it was the first time that I really felt the expansive cinematic nature of music. I mean, obviously, Fantasia is this visual feast. But beyond that, I found that it was so powerful in being able to evoke my own images. It could put me instantly into a kind of dreamlike state where reality and fantasy merged. My consciousness sort of dissipated, and I was part of something larger. And every time I hear it, I get different pictures in my head. And I'll reveal something to you that I've never talked about before. I have a neurological condition. ironically called aphantasia, which is that I am not able to form mental pictures in my brain. We think 5% of the population have this condition. And when I say I can't form pictures in my brain, if you say to me, imagine your car, I don't get pictures in my brain at all. I have a list of propositions, almost like a computer scientist. I know that my car is blue. I know that it doesn't have chrome in the front. It's propositions. I don't have a picture of it. I'm very bad at recognizing faces. But when music comes on while I'm awake or when I'm dreaming at night, my head fills with images.
Well, after we hear the Beethoven, I'll ask you what came into your mind. Thank you. We heard Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F major, the opening, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. And for you, Daniel, what did you see?
Well, I felt so many parts of my life represented. I saw children that I went to grammar school with playing. I saw them grow in my mind's eye, grow into adults. I had this image of the first time that I rode a horse. I'm riding a horse as a 10-year-old. It was as though you had made a movie of my life and set it to music. I heard striving, accomplishment, dancing, sorrow, ambition, disappointment, everything in that excerpt.
You grew up in California, Dan, didn't you?
I grew up in a small town in rural Northern California, surrounded by walnut and pear orchards and cattle ranches.
Very pastoral.
It was. And this is the Pastoral Symphony. It does evoke that Northern California bucolic upbringing. And the most extraordinary thing about that was that in this small school district, we had a music program. A teacher, Talmadge Eady was his name. He'd been in the military, trumpet player during the Korean War. And he went around to everybody's grade 3 classroom, introduced himself. He said, I'm the music teacher. The state of California has purchased instruments, enough for everybody in the school who wants to learn an instrument. We will give you an instrument that you can take home and keep for a year, and we will teach you to play it. And some of us signed up, some of us didn't, but that was the beginning of everything for me.
What instrument were you given?
Clarinet.
Your dad was a businessman.
He was.
Did he love music?
No. He was an accountant, a CPA, and an attorney. He had played clarinet as a child, and he'd played piano, but the only time he would put on music when I was growing up, once every couple of years, if he was in a particularly frivolous mood, he would put on Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, which I love. And then if we took car trips, he would put on Mantovani and Andre Castellanets, what we would now call Muzak, which I could not stand. It made me want to punch out the glass of the car.
But there was creativity in the family because your mum was a novelist.
A novelist who's published more than 40 young adult novels, one adult novel, picture books, and she was a pianist. She played piano from the time I was very young. My earliest memories of music were being 3 or 4 years old and lying on my back underneath the piano, underneath the Chickering Grand that we had inherited from my grandparents. And she played rather militaristically. She was born in Berlin. Metronomically is a better way to put it. If she played for Elise, it was da 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 da. It was never dee da dee da dee da dee da dee. She did not play romantically.
And was she very influenced by the things that she went through as a young woman?
Absolutely. Her family escaped the Nazis in 1938, rather late in the game. The entire extended family was murdered. Only the nuclear family got out. She was the youngest of 3 children, and all of them were, I mean, we throw around the word trauma like we throw around the word brilliant or genius. Where I live in Los Angeles, we say that person is a genius, referring to their ability to find a parking space. I mean, trauma is you don't get a parking space. But no, my mother and her sisters and family were deeply traumatized by the loss of their extended family, their history, their home, their livelihoods.
Did that impact on you, do you think?
I always knew from the youngest age that I was lucky to be alive, that my mother was lucky to be alive. And that messed with my head. It messes with a lot of children of Holocaust survivors, because from a young age, one is thrust into the very adult question of what is the purpose of life? Was my mother saved so that I could have fun? Was she saved so that I should do something meaningful with my life? They don't always go together.
There's a lot of guilt, too, isn't there, amongst people who have survived?
There's survivor's guilt, for sure, and I have that. Mm. But also, Michael, the guilt in not knowing what to do with a life that somehow feels like a special gift, nothing taken for granted. And it really messed me up in my teen years and my early 20s. I was directionless. I was a late bloomer because it was just too much for my puny brain to handle.
Now, as well as the clarinet, you started playing sax and guitar, didn't you?
So Mr. Eady put together a little ensemble when we were in grade 4, where we would play folk songs, maybe 20 of us, and we had to learn to play together, which is something that 9-year-olds are not very good at generally. We had to learn to listen to what the other person was doing. Think of it. I had to not just be thinking about what I was going to do, but coordinate when I was going to play and how loud with what other people were playing. And he's conducting. We had a concert band, wind ensemble, and he put together a jazz band. For the wind ensemble, he needed an alto clarinet. So now I had two instruments. In grade 7, when he put together the jazz band, he gave me a tenor saxophone. Now I had 3. And in grade 8, he taught me to conduct because he didn't want to go to the basketball games at night.
So this interest in jazz probably led to the next choice, which is Monk.
You know, I've always had a special affection for Monk because of my affection for Beethoven. In the Pathetique Sonata, there's this sort of run of an arpeggiated diminished chord that reminds me of boogie-woogie piano, stride piano, all that. And Monk has this sense of having been schooled on all of that. And the other thing that he does that I love is he plays adjacent notes, semitones, which are dissonant, but he does it because he's trying to emulate what, say, a trombone could do by sliding between notes, hitting them both at the same time. So Thelonious Monk.
Thank you.
so.
It's sort of outrageous, isn't it?
It is so outrageous that he does this modulation thing there. Ba-do-ba-da, 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 this chromatic modulation. He plays around with time. He plays around with your expectations so wonderfully. And then he throws in this kind of bluesy lick in the middle of all this delightful dissonance. Just, it's outrageous.
Well, you needn't. Composed and performed by Thelonious Monk. Do you think you got some of your interest in science from your grandfather?
Absolutely. My grandfather was a remarkable man, a Ukrainian refugee. He was a hard worker. He was the only one in his family to go to college, then put himself through medical school, became the first board-certified radiologist in California, founded the Department of Radiology at UC San Francisco Hospital, and loved science. He used to subscribe to Nature and Science magazines. And when I was very young, they would send these little experiments for kids to do. They were called Things of Science, and they'd come in little cardboard boxes every 3 weeks or so. And he would gleefully bring them over to the house on Sundays when he visited, and we would open them up, and we would do the experiments, and they would teach you optics or magnetism, or one of them was a little stargazer kit, and you could find the constellations. He built a telescope for me so that we could see the planets and the stars.
And how did you find high school?
I turned left on Croydon Road.
And when you got there, you didn't really enjoy it, did you?
I loathed high school. I don't know many people who did like it other than the people who peaked in high school. They were the sports people, cheerleaders, actors, musicians. There are a lot of people who peaked then. It was a period of social isolation and frustration for me. And yet, I made three of my best friends there. I got interested in audio equipment, and I would save up my money and I'd buy a new component. And my friend Jim Ferguson and John D'Arcy, the three of us would get together and we'd listen to records, and then we'd change the speakers out, or we'd swap amplifiers, and we were really attuned to it. John D'Arcy dropped out of college and became one of the inventors of the commercial subwoofer. How about that? I dropped out of college too, played in a series of bands. And when one of them broke up and I was really bereft and not sure what to do, John suggested that I might become a recording engineer. I thought, well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Dvorak next.
Dvorak. What a leap. I've often thought if there was some weird alternate universe where I only get one piece of music for the rest of my life, I would quickly grow tired of even my favorite pop songs. But Dvorak, that is some complicated stuff. I could listen to particularly this one 1,000 times, and it would always reveal something new to me. And I particularly like the last movement of this because it sounds to me like he's poking fun at all the symphonic composers before him, particularly poking fun at Beethoven and at endings. He's sort of setting up an ending. Bum, 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 ba-bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum. You know, the ending's coming, everybody. But then, no, it doesn't come at all. He goes into this really lyrical section. And then you think, oh, okay, he's finally winding up to the ending now. He's going to give you three big hits on the orchestra. No, it's six. I've studiously avoided reading anything about him or the piece because I love my fantasy that somewhere in his grave he's laughing at having pulled the rug out from under us over and over again.
Thank you.
It's just so wonderful. Every time I hear it, it feels different. And it's like a game for the brain. There's a part of your brain right here along the sides of your forehead. It's got the rather awkward name of Brodmann Area 47.
These are frontal lobes, presumably.
Yeah, prefrontal cortex. Yeah, frontal lobe. And what its job is, if nothing else, the brain is a giant prediction machine. To get out of the way if something harmful is coming, to find food, to find mates, avoid predators, all that. And to do that, our brains detect patterns. And Brodmann 47's job is to figure out what's going to happen next. And in music, that part of the brain is going nuts, trying to figure out, well, what's going to come next? And Dvorak completely subverts your expectations. And what that really is a preparatory activity for life. Now, I know this sounds grandiose, but it's preparing you to understand that the universe is not always going to deliver what you think it's going to deliver. You've got to be on your toes.
The finale of the Symphony No. 7 in D minor by Dvorak, performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic, conducted by Andrei Previn, who, of course, did cross all of the boundaries in music. Daniel, you've worked with a lot of extraordinary musicians, and I wonder which ones sort of stick in your mind as being particularly memorable.
I've just been so lucky. I feel that music is putting me in touch with something that is outside of our corporeal existence, and that the artists who are making it are channeling something special in the way that poets do. I feel that they're in touch with some metaphysical reality. And there are three artists that stand out for me, both for their artistry and their deep humanity. The bassist Victor Wooten, Bobby McFerrin, singer and conductor, and Stevie Wonder. They're like humans 2.0. The levels of compassion, empathy, emotional intelligence, patience. The other person I'll say, who's no longer with us, I knew George Martin, Beatles producer. When I was first getting into recording, I was maybe 23. And I've never had this experience before or since. In the room with George Martin, I felt like a bubble had enveloped us. And that if anything bad was going to happen in the world, it was not going to happen while George was there. And I had this explosive recognition that that is what enabled the Beatles' creativity, the sense of safety.
I get very much the impression that a lot of the music you've chosen is influenced by the performer, and that's certainly the case with the next piece.
The first time I heard Ciccolini was life-altering for me. It always sounds to me like I'm not in the same room as the piano. I'm in the next room, and I'm eavesdropping on his performance. And paradoxically, perhaps, it makes it feel more intimate. It's like he doesn't know I'm there, and I'm hearing his most private thoughts and private interactions with his piano. Thank you.
Gardens in the Rain from Estampes by Claude Debussy, performed by Aldo Ciccolini. Great technique there as well, of course.
Great technique. It's really on display here, which is why I'm glad we played this. But as often, his technique is in the service of pure emotion. I'm very particular about piano players and conductors and orchestras. I can't explain it.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the neuroscientist and writer Daniel Levitin. Daniel, why did you decide to leave life in the music business and become a neuroscientist?
The music business was falling apart. When I entered the business, there were 15 major record labels in the U.S. By 1990, there were only five, and the consolidation was carrying with it a lot of pressure to make more and more money, and there was less focus on artistry. When labels started dropping artists like Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Van Morrison because they weren't selling enough records, something seemed wrong. The other thing was some of the best music I'd ever heard and ever been involved with went nowhere. And some of the stuff that I thought was mediocre became really popular, and I didn't like that unpredictability.
You discovered that many people can sing songs from records they love in the same key as the disc. Why does that happen, and why is it important?
It's important from a theoretical standpoint because memory researchers for 100 years assumed that memory was not particularly accurate. And in many respects, it's not. We know that courtroom testimony is notoriously inaccurate. Memory is unreliable. If you remembered every precise detail of everything that happened, you'd be overloaded. But what we found in the laboratory, surprisingly, was if you ask people to reproduce from memory one of their favorite songs, they reproduce it at the actual pitch, at the actual tempo, and there's really no theoretical reason they would have to do that, because a song is defined by the pattern of notes, not the actual pitches. So Happy Birthday is Happy Birthday whether you sing it in A or A flat. It's still the same song, and yet our memory preserves the precise details. That threw memory research on its head. It suggested that music has some ancient evolutionary origin, that our memory for it should be so precise. It evolved for many different things, and one of them was the preservation of knowledge. We had to remember things like kinship relationships. You don't marry your cousin. This is the path to the well, and if that well's dry, you go to that well. Or don't go over that mountain because Uncle Zoc went over there and they killed him because they're mean people over there. All that, from what we know from contemporary hunter-gatherers, Michael, was encoded in song. Another is mothers comforting their infants. Another is to be able to communicate as a band of people around a fire, to sing together to ward off predators. Voices in unison and harmony sound like they're greater in number than a single voice alone just speaking.
Now, George Martin is not involved in this performance of a Beatles song. Tell me who is.
I am so fortunate to have grown up when the Beatles were still recording and to await new albums and to devour them. And there's a lot of harmonic complexity. But being able to hear the Beatles with fresh ears is very difficult because I know it so well. This next recording was a revelation to me. There's a Quebec-based group called Les Boreades that play Beatles songs on Baroque instruments, period instruments, arranged by Eric Milne. And when I first heard these, it was transformative, emancipated from the familiar sounds of pop music production and George Martin. As great as the records are, as masterful as they are bound to a certain time. What Milne does is he unshackles them and makes them timeless.
Thank you.
Dear Prudence by Lennon and McCartney, as performed by Les Boreades Ensemble, conducted by Eric Milne. Daniel Levitin, why is it that music has such an instantaneous effect on our emotions, can make us tap our feet or make us cry? Is it partially that thing of environment that our mother sang to a swimmer in the womb? What is it?
There's so many different things happening there. I'd like to unpack them separately. Movement, you mentioned. Our auditory system has direct connections to our movement centers. We call it the startle reflex. If you hear a loud sound, you jump out of the way. This is an evolutionary advantage. Sound enters the ear, it then goes to the auditory cortex and the cerebellum directly. The cerebellum is responsible for movement, motor cortex. Music is probably the only art form that makes you want to move to it. I don't see people dancing to the Mona Lisa at the Louvre. And the movement is automatic. The beat of the music causes us to want to wiggle and move in synchrony to it. We have entire populations of neurons, millions of neurons, that fire in synchrony to the tempo of music. So that's the movement part. But motion, non-coincidentally, is a part of the word emotion. Emotions move us in a very different way. Why music does it is still a mystery. I think you're onto something. It's echoes of our mothers singing to us, hearing our mother's heartbeat through the womb. Also, we heard music in the womb at the age of 20 weeks. The auditory system of the developing fetus is fully functional, and we're listening through the amniotic fluid. We hear the bass lines. We hear the percussion. But also, music activates the reward center of our brain, the same part of the brain that's activated when we're hungry and we eat, when we have sex, good news, a sunny day. Music activates that directly. It releases dopamine and endogenous opioids. Those neurochemicals unlock circuits in the brain that make us feel good. Music also directly taps into our hippocampus, the seat of memory. And so it can remind us of things we had forgotten. Multisensory memories, smells, sights, sounds, touch, even a sense of balance.
Do we process it in a different part of the brain from, for example, straight speech? I mean, I remember Oliver Sacks, who you knew well, saying to me, I think even on this program, that he had a patient who, if you said, do up your shoes, would look blankly. But if Oliver sang, do up your shoes, he bent down and did them up.
Our lab was among the first to show that speech and music use separate circuits, partially overlapping, of course, because it's sound, but partly separate. Also, some of the circuits that are overlapping function in a different mode when they're processing music versus speech. But the big picture story is that music activates every region of the brain that we know about. Speech does not. Music unifies and connects areas of the brain that other stimuli do not connect. That's really the answer to your question of where does musical emotion come from. It comes from uniting these disparate parts of the brain that otherwise would not be working in tandem.
That's very interesting. That's the best answer I've had to that question for a long time. You began to feel slightly uneasy, didn't you, when you were mapping the brain?
I did, and I felt kind of guilty. Suddenly brain imaging comes along and you can see the brain. You can catch the brain in the act of thinking. If I ask you to mentally practice your tennis serve, or to perform maths calculations, or to listen to or imagine music, I can see what's going on in the brain. But after years of that, it began to feel hollow. What have we actually learned other than where it is? It's like you pointing to a map and saying, that's Cardiff. I don't know anything about Cardiff except, well, it's there. So what?
That's very fascinating. Did that frustration slightly lead you to want to look at the healing properties of music?
Very much so. It was the dissatisfaction that we were doing neurocartography, but I wanted to actually go to the town and live there for a while. And music's most ancient use was for healing, healing rituals. That's what I'm writing about now in Music as Medicine, the actual scientific evidence that music can help with diseases like Parkinson's, disorders like depression, can treat Alzheimer's disease, things like that.
Tell me about your next track. It was also, I think, what you were listening to when you began writing the book.
I was writing the book during the lockdown. I was feeling, like many of us, emotionally fallow. And I thought what I needed for my soul was to do something that was spiritual and emotional, not technical. And I decided that I wanted to reacquaint myself with the piano. I'm going to take pieces I always knew how to play and try to make them sing. And I chose three pieces, the Chopin Prelude in E minor, Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, and the Pathetique Sonata, just the second movement, the Adagio Cantabile. Those I had under my fingers. I was a good enough pianist that I could play the notes. But I wanted to spend however much time it took to stop playing the notes and figure out if I could play music. And it took 2 years in the Pathetique of working on it every day before the story emerged. And in the midst of all that, I was listening to other people's versions trepidatiously. I was writing with my friend Mari Kodama, wonderful concert pianist. She had just recorded her own version of it. And when I heard that, I just fell apart. I just began crying my eyes out. It was just the most inventive and personal interpretation I could imagine. I had never heard anybody play it that way before. It sounded exactly right.
Thank you.
Her sense of timing is just exquisite. The pauses she puts in are so poignant. It's when she's not playing that is as moving as when she is.
The space between notes, the space between words, is as important as the notes and words themselves.
Absolutely, Michael. And what I hear in Mari's playing is a unique sense of control and inner peace.
We heard Slow Movement of the Pathetique, the piano sonata number 8 in C minor by Beethoven, played by Mari Kodama. Tell me, Daniel, how is it that things like post-traumatic stress disorder can be helped by music?
There's a program called Songwriting with Soldiers that kind of exemplifies this, which is you take the traumatic experience and you write a song about it and you get it outside your body. And you put it in an object that is something that's no longer inside you. You shine a light on it, and it allows you to see it objectively. Or just listening to music while recalling the memory, music that you and your therapist together have found that is relaxing for you, that can recontextualize the memory.
And have you experienced that extraordinary sensation that Leibniz writes about? Music is a hidden arithmetic exercise of the soul, which doesn't know that it is counting.
Very much so. And I love that quote. And Mari's husband, Kent Nagano, great conductor, who we will get to in a moment, he and I have had many conversations about the purpose of the arts in general, and of music in particular. And his thinking and Mari's both have shaped my musical and philosophical sensibility quite profoundly. And in particular, the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer writes that music is not merely a representation of the world. It's not depicting the world in the way that, say, a painting might be doing or a theater piece. It's not replicating the patterns around us, but instead it's an expression of the very will. Schopenhauer uses will as a kind of stand-in for the force that drives the universe in a metaphysical sense. So music is not a mirror of our experience, but a window that is a conduit into the deepest recesses of existence, potentially a world of higher dimensions. So we talk about the four-dimensional world, you know, length, width, height, and time. Physicists talk about how, well, maybe there are 30 or 40 dimensions. Here's an intriguing thought. Looking just at musical pitch, which is frequencies along a single-dimensional continuum, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, that's one dimension. But what the brain does with frequency, according to one of my mentors, Roger Shepherd, is it maps it on to five dimensions. Tonal relations, octaves, that's the second dimension. All octaves have a perceptual similarity. The circle of fifths.
Harmonics.
Harmonics, chords. When you add in timbre, which we believe is at least five dimensions, maybe more, rhythm, you're talking about being able to glimpse a higher dimensional universe that exists, and music is the only way we can experience it.
Well, it is Kent Nagano we're going to hear conducting now.
Yeah, so I chose the Mahler for the same reason I chose the Dvorak, which is that it's the kind of piece that you can hear for a lifetime and always find new surprises. It is so complex. And it's not a piece I try to understand or analyze. I just let it wash over me and let it take hold of me. And it's always a different ride.
Thank you.
The Scherzo from the Symphony No. 3 in D minor by Mahler, performed by the Deutsche Symphony Orchestra of Berlin, conducted by Kent Nagano. To take music as medicine, as a serious proposition, we obviously need quite robust ways of testing the effects of music on health. Are we actually seeing these results?
We are. We're seeing it most clearly with Parkinson's disease and movement disorders, helping people with Parkinson's to walk because they can synchronize their movements to music. We see it with stuttering. Stuttering is caused by an inability to regulate the motor system in time, but when they're singing, they don't stutter. Elvis Presley famously stuttered. Mm. Alzheimer's disease, we're seeing in controlled studies that agitation that accompanies many people with Alzheimer's is abated by listening to music. Or the sense of confusion and disorientation can be alleviated by playing familiar music.
Joni Mitchell was very much helped after her aneurysm, wasn't she?
Joni experienced an aneurysm in March of 2015 and was hospitalized. The aneurysm bled, and so she effectively had a hemorrhagic stroke and lost the ability to speak and lost movement. And she was sent home without any follow-up care because they figured it was a lost cause. But my phone number was pinned to the corkboard in her kitchen with just my name and phone number. And her nurses called me, wanted to know why my number was there. And I said, well, we're friends. And when I explained what I did for a living, they said, oh, well, it's interesting. Sometimes we'll be on break in the kitchen playing music, and from the other room, Joni seems to perk up. Is there anything we can do? And as it happens, Michael, in a kind of Jungian synchronicity, many years before, Joni had been asked to record a kind of desert island disc. And Joni had invited me over to her house for a series of listening evenings where the two of us would sit and just listen to record after record. And she would muse aloud about what she liked about it. So here was a ready-made antidote to her malady, her favorite songs. So I said to the nurses, this is where it is. It's in the living room. Look for that. Play it for her. Ask her first if she wants to hear it, because part of music therapy is the patient must feel some agency and control. So they began playing it for her. And in a very short time, she began responding to it and becoming more alert and getting back in touch with that self she had lost.
To what extent is somebody like Joni Mitchell susceptible to the benefits of a kind of musical treatment, if you like, as opposed to somebody that hasn't had a very deep contact with music?
There are a lot of anecdotes of people who were not musical who became musical, and a lot of anecdotes about people who music saved in some fashion or treated. Now, of course, the plural of anecdote is not data, but we've seen in hospital wards and care units, people who are not musicians and didn't particularly immerse themselves in music still experience the curative benefits of music.
Bach is certainly a balm for most musicians.
You know, I chose Bach because we don't have modern music without Bach. And I love Daniel Barenboim.
Thank you.
Prelude number 19 in A major from Book 2 of The Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach, performed by Daniel Barenboim.
I hear in Barenboim's playing a very powerful femininity and delicacy, a more romantic interpretation of Bach than many other pianists.
Dan, you argue that music is important in building healthy societies. What do you mean by that?
In the broadest sense, I think that music allows us to engage in an active imagination. We can imagine viewpoints different from the ones we may hold, perspectives different from the ones we've considered, a different world than the one we know, perhaps a better world. And through the act of imagining a better world, only then can we build one.
And as you said earlier, the whole corporate thing of listening to each other is quite important. But I wonder whether you also think it's important to branch out, to embrace new musics, to discover things that you've not heard before.
Very much so. I think there is familiarity in our old friends and comfort, but there's excitement and neuroplasticity, reward in making new friends. One of the most complicated things for the brain is what you and I are doing right now. Two people who don't know each other, having a conversation, trying to find common ground. It's one of the most neuroprotective things you can do. Meet new people, people from different backgrounds, younger people, people from other countries, other religions. That's going to strengthen the brain because it requires you to think differently. And listening to different musics is an essential part of that throughout the lifespan, but especially as we get older.
As our final track, what have you chosen?
Classical composers famously would listen to the music of other cultures, Bartok, Tchaikovsky in the Nutcracker Suite. The reverse is also true in this next selection. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who was a Qawwali singer, wanted to work with a Western musician to better understand Western music. Michael Brook is a Canadian composer, one of the founders of the ambient music movement, a guitarist who recorded with Brian Eno. But here he's with Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan on My Heart, My Life, and it really is an exercise in East meets West.
Well, on that very happy note, let me just thank you very much, Daniel Levitin.
It's been a real privilege. Thank you, Michael.
Sabne tu, bata ramen, parvele mo, takti. Heart, My Life by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and Michael Brook. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the psychologist and neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week at the same time, Michael's guest is the poet Imtiaz Darker.
Earlier, with me, Jules Holland, on BBC Radio 3. Every Saturday lunchtime, I share my passion for classical music and its connection with jazz and blues. I play some of my favourite music and receive a visit from some amazing and fascinating guests. Laura Mvula, the wonderful Yaz Ahmed, Robin Katz, Pete Long, welcome to the programme.
Can I have the piano?
Please do.
Just remember the five-part harmony and my auntie singing bass. And I just thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever heard.
Earlier, with me, Jules Holland. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea. I'm here with you for the rest of the day on BBC Radio 3. And if you're still listening later, you may like to know that our Sunday feature is looking at the important role played by music in the films of the late Anthony Minghella. Juliet Stevenson worked with him, most memorably in the film Truly Madly Deeply, and she'll be hearing from his family and other friends and colleagues about how music shaped his life and career. That's Anthony Minghella and Music, our Sunday feature at 7:15 this evening. But now it's 1:30 and time for Music Map. This week's episode is boldly going where no man or woman has gone before. Space, the final frontier. Here's Sarah Moore-Peach for your onward journey.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach, and on this show, I guide your ears through a kind of listening journey towards a single destination point on our musical map. The landscape we pass through to get there is peppered with pieces that are in some way connected to that destination, which we hear in full at the end of the show. This is Neptune, the Mystic, the final piece in the Planet Suite by Gustav Holst. It's the work that the early 20th century English composer is best known for, his orchestral blockbuster. And when the Planets were first performed in London in 1918, Neptune was the bit that made the audience gasp with delight. Over the next hour and a half, we'll explore just how Holst did that, digging into some of the sounds that he draws out of the orchestra and those ethereal voices. But we're going to start more broadly, gazing up at the night sky.